Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
Hello and welcome to Reality Check. Today is Tuesday, the 27th of October, 2009, and I'm your host, Tony Pittman. And this is episode 13 of Reality Check. Here on Joy 94.9. Yes, we're up to lucky 13 already. Reality Check is a show designed to give you a healthy dose of reality. And we do that by promoting the art of critical thinking and skeptical analysis. Each week we bring you a roundup of LGBT news, followed by an in-depth analysis of an issue related to the paranormal or the pseudoscientific. And finally, we wrap up each show with a movie review. On today's show, after our LGBT news roundup, we're going to continue our examination of the strange and unearthly phenomenon of UFOs. We'll have a look at how the evidence for extraterrestrial visits of Earth stacks up, and we'll also talk to an expert in the field. An astrophysicist. Then in our movie review section, we'll have a look at a new British documentary, In Search of Beethoven. So for all that and more, stay tuned here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9. Okay, here's our LGBT news roundup for the last week or so. And we begin our roundup in the capital of the world's superpower, Washington, D.C., where last Thursday, October 22nd, the U.S. Senate passed a piece of legislation called the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crime Prevention Act, an act that expands existing U.S. federal hate crime law to include crimes motivated by a victim's actual or perceived gender, sexual orientation, gender identity, or disability. The U.S. House of Representatives passed the bill back on October the 8th, so it now goes directly from the Senate to President Obama, who has said that he will sign the bill into law. And when he does that, this will actually be the first ever federal civil rights legislation for LGBT people in the history of the United States. So quite an historic moment, in fact. Actually, they've been fighting for this bill for over 12 years now, so it's great that they've finally got it. Until now, the U.S. federal hate crimes law covered crimes committed on the basis of race, color, religion, national origin, or ethnicity. So this new legislation adds several new categories to those. And as for what hate crimes legislation actually does, well, basically it mandates increased penalties for offenders if it can be proven that their crime was motivated by enmity against one of those protected groups. This act in particular also provides extra resources to state and local law enforcement officials and gives the U.S. Justice Department the power to investigate hate crimes that local officials decline to pursue. Now, there is some debate about the very concept of hate crime legislation and whether it's justifiable, but I'm not going to get into that debate today. I'm simply reporting on what the U.S. Congress has done. And I guess whatever you think of hate crimes legislation per se, it seems to me a good thing that if you're going to have it, it should include sexual orientation and gender identity as well as the other categories. Because, well, homophobia and transphobia are certainly a factor in a lot of violent crime committed against LGBT people. The only odd thing about this US legislation is that it was attached to a Defense Department funding bill. So the Congress were actually voting on national defense funding with the hate crimes extensions tagged on to the bill. Now, this form of piggybacking of one bill onto another is actually quite common in the US Congress. It does seem very strange to me, but that's how they do it. Now, speaking of hate crimes, let's move to Rome, where, unfortunately, a couple of weeks ago, the Italian Parliament voted not to extend existing hate crimes protections to LGBT people. Their hate crimes law already applies to crimes committed on the grounds of nationality, ethnicity, and religious belief, but not sexual orientation or gender identity. This decision not to extend the hate crimes protections was strongly supported by the Catholic Church. And after it was made, that sparked a round of protests on the streets of Rome a couple of weekends ago, the weekend of October 17th and 18th. As you may recall, we reported a few weeks ago here on Reality Check that 30,000 people had marched in a torchlight vigil in Rome in late September against what appears to be increasing homophobic violence throughout Italy. According to figures from the main Italian LGBT rights association, Arcigay, there were 8 homophobic murders and 52 non-lethal attacks against LGBT people in Italy during the first 9 months of this year. There was even an attack against a barman coming out of a gay bar the very same night as the torchlight vigil was held. And the most recent attack came just a couple of weeks ago on October the 11th and was against a gay couple by a group of youths on motorbikes in the center of Rome in broad daylight. So really not a very cheerful situation for LGBT people in Italy these days. But with the right-wing Berlusconi back in power now for the third time, and of course with the Holy Father Ratzinger regularly making his vile pronouncements against LGBT people, it doesn't come as much of a surprise, unfortunately. And speaking of His Holiness, let's move now back across the Atlantic to a country where the Catholic Church wields an obscene amount of political power, and that is Honduras. And unfortunately, the situation in Honduras remains very precarious, with President Zelaya still holed up inside the Brazilian embassy. So just as a reminder of the background to all this, Zelaya was elected president of Honduras in 2006, but was ousted in a coup on June 28th this year and expelled from the country. But he managed to sneak back in surreptitiously and appeared at the Brazilian embassy in Tegucigalpa on September 21st, and that's where he remains, holed up and surrounded by hundreds of Honduran soldiers. So a very dicey situation, and as we reported here before on Reality Check, also a dicey situation for human rights, and particularly the human rights of LGBT people. Now, Honduras has never been a place where human rights are greatly respected, but it seems that since the coup in June, the level of tension, violence, and impunity has increased significantly, with security forces cracking down on supporters of President Zelaya, and apparently unhindered by legal constraints. There is now a tangible level of fear on the streets these days. and groups that were already vulnerable before the coup are now at even greater risk. And those groups, of course, include LGBT people. And unfortunately, six gay men or transgender women have been murdered since the June coup, with what appears to be complete impunity. So really a very worrying situation there in Honduras, and one that doesn't look like it's going to get better in a hurry, unfortunately. And finally, for our last news item today, let's cross the Atlantic one more time back to Germany, where Chancellor Angela Merkel finally finished all her post-election wrangling at the weekend and announced her new cabinet on Sunday, which will include an openly gay man, Guido Westerwelle, as the country's foreign minister. And as far as I know, the first openly gay foreign minister in the history of the modern world. Guido Westerwelle is the leader of the Free Democrats, a liberal pro-business party, with which Angela Merkel's Christian Democratic Union formed a coalition. Apparently, he has little foreign affairs experience, so it will be interesting to see how he goes. And also interesting that Germany should get its first openly gay foreign minister under a conservative government. Interesting developments all around there. So after Iceland got the first openly LGBT prime minister in modern history when a lesbian took over the reins there this year, 2009 also sees the first openly LGBT foreign minister. So we're living in exciting times, folks, when history is being made. And you will, of course, always hear about it on Reality Check. All right, that's enough LGBT news for today. We'll listen to a song now and then continue our examination of the mysterious phenomenon of UFOs when we come back. But first, I wanted to ask you, you've heard of Carl Sagan and Stephen Hawking, right? I mean, they're two of the most popular and widely known scientists of the last 40 years or so. But have you ever heard them singing? And singing together in the same song? Well, listen carefully to this song, and I'll tell you all about it when we come back here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9.
I'm not very good at singing songs, but here's a try. Scratch. You must first invent the universe. Space is filled with a network of wormholes. You might emerge somewhere else in space. Somewhere else in time.
The sky calls to us. If we do not destroy ourselves, we will one day venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits. Not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 million suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truths of exquisite interrelationships of the awesome machinery of nature.
I believe our future depends powerfully on how well we understand this cosmos, in which we float like a mote of dust. In the morning sky.
The brain does much more than just recollect. It intercompares, synthesizes, analyzes, it generates abstractions. The simplest thought, like the concept of the number one, has an elaborate logical underpinning. The brain has its own language for testing the structure and consistency of the world. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose. A morning filled with 400 billion. Rising of the Milky Way. The sky calls to us. If we do not destroy ourselves, we will one day venture to the stars. Ooh.
have wondered about the universe. Did it stretch out forever, or was there a limit? From the Big Bang to black holes, from dark matter to a possible Big Crunch, our image of the universe today is full of strange-sounding ideas.
How lucky we are to live in this time, the first moment in human history when we are, in fact, visiting other worlds.
A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way.
A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way.
Surface of the Earth is the shore of the cosmic ocean. Recently we've waded a little way up, and the water seems inviting.
Welcome back to Reality Check. I'm Tony Pittman, and the station is Joy 94.9. And the song you just heard there was A Glorious Dawn by Carl Sagan featuring Stephen Hawking. Well, okay, not really by them, but they were definitely their voices you heard there. Okay, so maybe it wasn't Stephen Hawking's real voice, because, of course, he can't speak, but it was definitely the highly recognizable voice there of his famous voice synthesizer. Anyway, what I really wanted to let you know is that that song is the creation of a guy called John Boswell. And I reckon he's a genius for what he can do with the voices and video of some of the world's greatest science communicators, and how he can put that with music he himself composes. So if you get the chance, check out his website. It's at symphonyofscience.com. There you can see the video for that song we just played, Glorious Dawn, and you can see another more recent video he's made called We're All Connected. That one featuring Carl Sagan, Richard Feynman, Neil deGrasse Tyson, and Bill Nye. And I've got to tell you, I love those two songs. I actually found out about them by reading the Gaytheists blog. That's at gaytheists.org. And the blogger there, J.R. Braden, talked about that site and said that he couldn't get the songs out of his head. So I went and checked out the videos, and I too was strangely moved and haunted by them, and also hooked by them, and kept wanting to go back and watch them again and again. Basically, what John Boswell does is he's taken the original footage of Carl Sagan or whoever actually saying those words that he uses in the song, and then he's fine-tuned them to create the melody, and it's just mesmerizing to watch. And I actually contacted him last week and got permission to play his songs here live to air and also include them in the podcast version of the show. So I'm very excited to be able to play his music here on Reality Check. So if you can, do try to check out the videos at symphonyofscience.com. They come highly recommended. Now we move into the part of the show where we examine in depth a topic related to pseudoscience or the paranormal. And today we're going to continue with our examination that we began last week of the mysterious phenomenon of UFOs. Last week we had a look at the history of UFO culture, and we also spoke to a physics professor from Melbourne University who said that even if intelligent extraterrestrials do exist on other planets, it seems it would be pretty difficult for them to cross the vast distances of space to come and visit us. At least given our current understanding of the laws of physics. Today we're going to have a broad look at the evidence for UFOs and see how it stands up to critical analysis. We're also going to talk to another physics professor, an astrophysicist, who lectures specifically on the possibility of life elsewhere in the universe, to get her take on the likelihood that extraterrestrial visitors are already paying us a visit. So first of all, let's take a closer look at the UFO phenomenon and see if we can conclude from that whether we are in fact being visited by extraterrestrials or not. Now first up, I want to make a confession. I believe in UFOs. I really do. I'm a full-blooded, dyed-in-the-wool skeptic, but I believe in UFOs. Yes, UFOs. That is, unidentified flying objects. I believe that sometimes there are flying objects in the sky, and that some of the people observing them are unable to identify them. They are, therefore, literally, unidentified flying objects. So I believe that people often see things in the sky that they cannot identify. It's the huge jump in logic, the huge leap of faith that goes from, I saw something in the sky I couldn't identify, to, I saw an extraterrestrial spaceship. Now that's the part where I'm not a believer, and that's where I need a little bit more convincing. Actually, I saw a lecture last year by the famous American astronomer Neil deGrasse Tyson, who, as I mentioned, appears in one of those Symphony of Science videos. Anyway, he said that it's funny how people seem to forget what the letter U stands for in UFO. You saw something, you can't identify it, it's unidentified. So what would make you then go and identify it as an alien spacecraft? Of course, in the public imagination, the term UFO has pretty much become synonymous with a spacecraft piloted by extraterrestrial beings. Now, before we advance any further with this discussion, this is probably a fitting moment to talk about a concept that we haven't discussed yet on Reality Check, but is something that every good critical thinker needs to be aware of, and is very pertinent to the subject at hand, and that is the concept of Occam's Razor. Occam's Razor is basically a rule of thumb first posited by the 14th century English logician and friar William of Occam. And it goes something like this. When you have two or more competing theories that make exactly the same predictions, the simpler one is the better. It doesn't mean that the simpler one is necessarily the correct one, but it's generally the one that will be most likely. Another way to put it is, when trying to explain a phenomenon, you should favor the explanation that involves the fewest assumptions or the fewest additional entities and yet still completely explains the phenomenon in question. Let me give you a very simple example. If you leave a glass of milk on a table, and you go out of the room for a few moments, and when you come back, the glass has been knocked over and the cat is lapping up the spilt milk. Well, the simplest explanation, the one that involves the fewest assumptions, is that the cat knocked over the glass. But if your friend insists that she thinks that a giant pink rabbit from another galaxy teleported here, knocked over the glass, and then teleported back to its home planet, well, that's one possible explanation of what happened, and it's not falsifiable. I mean, you can't prove it didn't happen, but as a skeptic, you would be wise to apply Occam's Razor and favor the simplest explanation, because the intergalactic rabbit explanation involves many more assumptions than the simple explanation that the cat did it. Of course, this is a very basic summary of Occam's Razor, and in the real world, the situations are much more complicated, and it may be much harder, in fact, to determine what the simplest explanation is. But hopefully I've made the general point of Occam's Razor clear. And the case of UFOs is a classic case where it's very useful to apply Occam's Razor to the evidence put before us. So what is that evidence? Well, there are loads and loads of accounts of UFOs. Eyewitness testimonies from people who saw things in the sky that they couldn't identify. There are also heaps of photographs and video footage of strange, unidentified things in the sky. And depending on the specific case, there may be radar anomalies involved or even burn marks on the ground, supposedly where the UFO landed. So when you come to look at any specific case, a skeptical approach will always be to apply Occam's razor to the evidence before you. So if you see a photo of a strange, blurry, grey object in the sky, and you know that there were a lot of birds around on that day, well, it seems you might have two competing hypotheses here. One is that it was a bird, the other that it was a spacecraft flown by extraterrestrials. Now, the explanation that involves the extraterrestrial creatures involves two very big assumptions that are not made in the explanation involving the bird. First, that intelligent extraterrestrial creatures exist, and also, secondly, that they're visiting Earth in spaceships. So two major assumptions there. Therefore, applying Occam's razor would lead to the conclusion that the best explanation for that grey, blurry object in the photo is, in fact, that it was a bird. Okay, once again, a very simplistic example, but useful to show the types of assumptions that people who believe in extraterrestrial visitors always make. And they're assumptions that they're really not justified in making. And here we can apply another skeptical rule of thumb, this time one often mentioned by the late great American astronomer Carl Sagan, whose voice we heard earlier in the show, in the song from Symphony of Science, and that is that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. The claim that Earth is being visited by intelligent aliens is indeed an extraordinary claim, and therefore we'd need pretty extraordinary, compelling evidence to be convinced that it was true. But we do have extraordinary evidence, say the believers. We have mountains of evidence, all those testimonials, all those people who've seen UFOs, all those photos and videos. What more evidence do you need? Well, that's a question that I put to Professor Rachel Webster, an astrophysicist from the University of Melbourne, and we'll hear her response when we come back after this song here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au, or if you're in Melbourne, tune in to Joy 94.9.
You're listening to Joy 94.9. The show is Reality Check, and I'm your host, Tony Pittman. And the song you just heard there was Kelly Watch the Stars by French duo Air from the year 1998. Now, let's continue our discussion of UFOs and extraterrestrial life, and let's go straight to an interview I recorded a few days ago with an astrophysicist from Melbourne University. Is the evidence of alien visitation of Earth convincing? Well, let's hear what she has to say. Okay, joining me on the phone now is Professor Rachel Webster. She's a professor in astrophysics at the University of Melbourne. Thanks for joining us on Reality Check, Professor Webster.
It's a pleasure, Tony.
Now, let me put to you the standard argument of the believers that we are being visited by extraterrestrial beings. They would say something along the lines of, well, okay, maybe we don't have unequivocal evidence, maybe we don't have a crashed flying saucer or the body of an alien, but look at the mountain of evidence that we have. We have so many eyewitness accounts, we have so many blurry photos, blurry videos, that's good evidence. You can't deny that we're being visited by extraterrestrials. What would your response be to that?
Well, it's very interesting that you say blurry photos, blurry videos, and all of that. I think all of this points to the fact that the evidence is actually not very strong. Why are the photos always blurry? There are many, many photos taken in the world that are not blurry. Why is none of the evidence unequivocal? And I think, on occasions people have approached me with images and photos, and they look interesting. They're definitely not the usual things that you see, but I think in every case where you think about it hard enough, you find that there's quote unquote a natural explanation for it.
Yeah, that for every picture or video that you actually start to investigate, you can find a fairly mundane, or maybe not even mundane, maybe unusual, but still terrestrial explanation.
Yes. I mean, there are a lot of very interesting weather phenomena, for example. There are now thousands of satellites up, which create all sorts of interesting effects through the atmosphere and so on. So, there's a lot of things you have to look at before, you would argue for anything extraterrestrial.
Yes, and then applying Occam's razor, you would have to come down to the conclusion that most likely it's something of this Earth.
Yep.
All right, now you actually give a course in possible life, other life in the universe, other intelligent life. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, well, astronomers, a group of astronomers have been looking at the possibility of extraterrestrial life for a very long time, decades, in fact. And the searches are really quite sophisticated. They, they've thought very hard about what intelligent life elsewhere in our galaxy might, how it might communicate and what it might communicate.
Right, this is the SETI program, is
well,
it?
Yep. The SETI program, and there have been others similar to it.
Yep.
But yes, those programs typically piggyback on astronomical observations, although there are some dedicated facilities being built as well. But so far, no luck with any of those. Of course, the amount of time they've been on the air and the places they've looked are not huge, but definitely no signals yet.
And well, what do you think is the likelihood that there is intelligent life somewhere else, at least in the galaxy or in the universe?
On probability grounds, I would say quite high. I don't think there's any special reason why life should have developed on Earth and nowhere else. So I think in all likelihood, and there's an awful lot of locations out there in the galaxy, potentially other solar systems where life might have evolved. So I think the probability is quite reasonable. But, those life forms, first of all, those life forms may not have evolved to the point where they can communicate with us. And then secondly, if they have, they may be so far away that, the timescales for them communicating with us and us back again might be so long that it's impractical. But I don't have any difficulty thinking that there may be life out there.
And, of course, I think, if I understand right, then another problem is that even if they were sending signals to us, we would have to have our equipment trained exactly in their direction, and the sky is a very big place, so maybe we wouldn't have found them yet because we just wouldn't have looked there.
That's right. And searches like SETI are actually targeted at, stars that might have solar systems, that might have planets like ours that might have life. But, there's only, hundreds of those have been searched, which is still fairly low probability.
Look, can you just tell us a bit about the Drake equation? Because I understand that this is a way to kind of formulate, in fact, this question, the likelihood that there is intelligent life.
So the Drake equation is formulated as a probability calculation, and it basically estimates how many civilizations there might be in our galaxy. So this is not beyond our galaxy, but just in our galaxy, which might have life that is intelligent and might have developed the capacity to communicate. So it's a series of factors which get multiplied together to give you the right number. So, you say how many stars are there in the galaxy, and then how many of those might have a planet like Earth, and on how many of those might life have evolved, and then you go through all of those factors, and for some of those, for example, a number of stars that might have planets like Earth is pretty high, fairly high fraction of them, and you're starting out, remember, with about 10 billion stars, so you're starting out with a lot of potential sites.
Yeah.
But the last factor, it becomes very interesting, though. The last factor in the equation is how long would a civilization that had the potential to communicate, how long would that civilization survive? Now, the potential to communicate for us on Earth has only been since the end of the Second World War and the development of radar, because any signals that we get will almost certainly be radio signals, because they're the only ones that can travel through space unattenuated. So we've only been this sort of civilization for, 70-odd years, which is not very long.
No, especially when you put it in the perspective of the life of the universe.
That's right. So... And then you say, well, how long is our civilization going to survive? Mm. And, if you're a bit of a pessimist, you this sort of moves around a bit depending on the politics of the day, but, you might say, well, look, we're probably going to blow ourselves up in 100 years because, somebody's going to misbehave. And then we will have only survived, 100 or 200 years. And if you put that factor into the Drake equation, then it turns out that we may very well be the only civilization, here.
At the moment.
No, that's right. Mm-hmm. But if you say, well, look, we're actually going to get a bit smarter and, mankind's going to learn how to live with each other and so on and so forth, and we can survive for 10,000 or 100,000 years in a state of, moderately intelligent, civilized, social interaction.
Yeah.
And once you start putting the big numbers in there, it turns out that the probability of another civilization in the galaxy is quite high, and so there may be quite a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the corollary of that is that if such civilizations are long-lived, then any civilization that could communicate with us is way, way more advanced than we are on probability grounds. They haven't just arrived at this state of being able to communicate as we have, but they've been able to do this, for 10,000 or 100,000 years. So they're way, way ahead of us.
Right.
And this brings me to my strongest argument as to why I don't think we really have been visited, or if we have, it's been a pretty rare occurrence, which is that anybody who can get here is much, much more advanced than we are. And why the evidence that they would leave behind is what I term fairies at the bottom of the garden is quite beyond me.
Right.
So, they could do all sorts of things, and they're not going to sort of stamp around in a few cornfields and that sort of stuff. I mean, it's just ridiculous, if you see what I mean.
Or just hover above people on a remote country road at night and then
disappear. Yeah. That just doesn't make any sense. When people put forward those sort of arguments, it's just hard to see that they're credible.
The other kind of question, or the issue that you implied there, is that it's also kind of a question of coincidence in time, that if a civilization does appear and lasts for a certain amount of time, then there would have to be either the coincidence that it's existing now at this moment, which, in the whole span of the life of the universe is a very brief moment.
That's right.
And that it's close enough for its signal to be getting to us now, and maybe a million years ago or something.
That's right. So the answer is, if anybody's visiting us, they've got to have been around for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And if they've been around for a long time, they're sophisticated, and they're not going to be fooling around with, the sorts of things that people who claim to see UFOs generally purport.
Can I just put to you another proposition that I saw a few months ago on a TV program, and I'd never thought about, but then I thought it did sound quite interesting. And that is that, as I understand, there are some private companies, at least in the United States, who charge people to send their own personal messages to outer space. So these companies are broadcasting signals straight up into into outer space, basically. And there was a naysayer on this show who was saying, look, with these signals and all the other signals that Earth is emitting straight into outer space, maybe this is not such a good idea, because maybe if there are other intelligences out there, what reason do we have to believe that they're benevolent, that they're nice? Maybe all we're doing by sending signals out there is indicating to them, hey, look, we're over here, here we are, so they can come and exploit us, take our resources and attack us. I don't know if you've ever heard of that.
So that one, I again usually go back to the same argument that I just mentioned, which is, if anybody is that sophisticated, they have to have survived for a long time. And to have survived for a long time, in my book, they've got to, they can't be too aggressive and antagonistic, or they would have destroyed themselves.
Right.
in my view, evolution and development go hand in hand with not being aggressive, but in fact being much more benign.
Right, okay, yes, having found ways to live in harmony with each other.
Well, that's right. I mean, we know from human history that, you know, civilizations that are aggressive, you know, end up self-destructing.
Yes, as we know, yes, too well from human history.
Yep.
All right, well, I think that covers it, Professor Webster, so it looks like, unfortunately, we're not currently being visited by extraterrestrials, but...
It'd be great if we were.
It would,
but
wouldn't it?
I don't think so.
No, all right. Well, hopefully at some time within our lifetimes, we'll make a discovery. That would be very exciting.
Okay.
All right, Professor Webster, thank you very much for joining us
here
on Reality Check.
So there you have it, dear listener. Even a professor of astrophysics who teaches a course on the possibility of life elsewhere in the universe has to admit that it seems pretty unlikely that we are being visited by intelligent beings from other planets. But what about all those sightings? So many people claim to have seen UFOs, and many of them are upstanding and honest members of the community. So what's going on here? How can you explain that? Well, some of them are simply lying. They're pure hoaxes, nothing more. But not most of them. Most people who see UFOs genuinely saw something in the sky that they can't explain. And sometimes these people are even pilots or engineers or police officers, highly regarded professions, and people think that their eyewitness accounts should be credible evidence. But actually, that's not necessarily the case. And the reason is quite simply because everyone can be fooled. Because to be able to understand every type of phenomenon in the sky that you might happen to see, you would need an extremely wide knowledge indeed. Now, there's a very good article on just this point in the January 2009 issue of Skeptical Inquirer magazine, in which astronomer James McGahey points out all the skills, the knowledge and experience that you would need to be able to critically analyze and determine what you see in the sky. Because there are lots of things that people mistake for UFOs. There are flying things, flying objects like satellites or meteors, aircraft, flares, balloons, birds, insects, even leaves, and other things that can fly around in the sky. And then there are also things that don't exactly fly, but are also mistaken for UFOs, things like clouds or lightning or other strange weather phenomena. And even planets or the stars or even the moon are sometimes mistaken for UFOs. So to be able to understand and determine what you're seeing, you need a pretty good knowledge of a lot of fields, of astronomy and of the positions of the brightest planets and the stars in the sky, as well as meteors and how the moon can appear at certain times and from certain positions. You also need a good knowledge of meteorology, so you can understand cloud formation as well as all the different types of lightning that can exist and other atmospheric phenomena. Plus, you need to have a good understanding of aeronautics and how aircraft can behave, as well as missiles, satellites, and balloons. Plus, a knowledge of optical illusions, mirages, and halos, and how searchlights or other forms of light can behave when reflected back from the atmosphere. Then on top of all that, you need a knowledge of how the brain can deceive itself. This involves psychology and sociology, the unreliability of memory and biases that can affect our perception. The thing is that human beings are not objective recording instruments. Human perception is in fact extremely unreliable. So, if you ask how can so many people think they saw a spaceship when they didn't, Well, very easily. They were deceived. They misinterpreted what they observed. It can happen to absolutely anyone. But what about all those photos and all that video and the marks on the ground and the anomalies on the radar screen, etc.? Well, as Professor Webster said, all that evidence, every single piece of so-called evidence, is equivocal or ambiguous or could have another earthly explanation besides being an extraterrestrial spaceship. And that's basically it. That's the clincher. That's what it all comes down to. With over 60 years now of UFO sightings, there has never been a single, clear, unequivocal, compelling piece of evidence. Never. And it's pretty much the same, you know, you see it, the same thing for psychics and the same for ghosts and for the Loch Ness Monster and Bigfoot, those other creatures. There has never been a straightforward, unambiguous, convincing piece of evidence. And most importantly, a huge pile of bad evidence will never make a convincing case, no matter how much more bad equivocal evidence you add to it. Because it's not the quantity that matters, but the quality. Just one piece of good, compelling evidence would be enough to convince the skeptics. But unfortunately, it just doesn't exist. So I'm afraid to say, dear listener, that applying Occam's razor to all the evidence put before us, our conclusion for today on Reality Check is that we are not, in fact, being visited by extraterrestrials. As amazing as that would be, unfortunately, it doesn't look like it's happening. However, unlike a lot of stuff that we talk about here on Reality Check, it's not impossible. So, fingers crossed that we discover within our lifetimes intelligent life elsewhere in the galaxy. Now that would probably be the most exciting moment in the history of humanity. I hope we're around to see it. Now, finally, before we get into our last song, if you have any questions or comments about what we've covered on the show, or maybe something you'd like us to cover on the show, please feel free to send us an email. The address is realitychecktony, T-O-N-Y, at gmail.com. You can also visit our webpage too, that's realitycheckonline.net. There you can download past episodes of Reality Check. All right, let's listen to our last song for today, and when we come back, we'll get into this week's movie review.
Joy. Joy. 94.9.
Over 200 volunteers bring you joy every week. Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Reality Check with me, Tony Pittman, on Joy 94.9. Also streaming live at joy.org.au and also available as a podcast to listen to anywhere in the world on your little pod. The song you just heard there was Still Reminds Me by Indonesian singer Anggun from the year 2000. Now we arrive at the part of Reality Check where we give you a review of a film on current release here in Melbourne. And the movie up for review this week is In Search of Beethoven, a new British documentary by Phil Grabsky about, of course, the great German composer Ludwig van Beethoven. 3 years ago, Grabsky released the documentary In Search of Mozart, and this year he's come back to take on that other great god of classical music. Grabsky's philosophy is that to really understand and appreciate the music of these great composers, you need to know what was happening in their lives at the time that they composed a particular piece. And so, basically, he goes through Beethoven's life and looks at what was happening both personally and on the broader political scene at the time he wrote each of his greatest works. And of course, Beethoven did have an interesting life. He was born in Bonn in Germany and moved to Vienna in his early 20s and basically stayed there for the rest of his life. He arrived in Vienna in 1792, just a year after Mozart's death. Haydn was living in Vienna then too and was still alive and was an old man when Beethoven arrived, and the two did get to know each other. The three of them, Mozart, Haydn, and Beethoven, were regarded during Beethoven's lifetime as the three greatest composers of the era. So while he was professionally very successful, Beethoven's personal life was not such a success. He had a pretty disastrous love life and never married. All the women he fell in love with were from the aristocracy. And although he was the most famous pianist and composer in Europe at the time, the class strictures of the time were still too strong. And not having been born into the aristocratic class himself, he could never convince any of the objects of his affection to marry him, unfortunately. And of course, the most tragic thing about his personal life is that in his late 20s, he started to lose his hearing and was pretty much completely deaf by his late 40s. Yet he continued to compose music, even composing some of his best-known pieces towards the end of his life. The political events during Beethoven's life are also particularly dramatic. Beethoven was born in 1770 and died in 1827. So that means he lived through two of the most pivotal and far-reaching events in European history, if not the history of the world: the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars. He was even living in Vienna during the two occupations by Napoleon's Grande Armée and was also there for the post-war negotiations at the Congress of Vienna in 1814. I'd never really appreciated these historical connections before, so I found that part of the film particularly interesting. And, well, having mentioned Mozart, that reminds me of the story of the famous complaint of the Holy Roman Emperor Joseph II. After watching Mozart's opera The Marriage of Figaro, he said it was quality work, but there were simply too many notes for his liking. And that, I have to say, is also my complaint with this film. Well, what I mean is, I think I would have preferred a documentary on the life and times of Beethoven, with a strong emphasis on all those dramatic political events engulfing Europe at the time. Whereas the focus of this documentary is much more on the music, which personally is only of passing interest to me. And after so many interviews with pianists talking about how revolutionary it was for Beethoven to change at this point in the sonata from G major to B major, well, my eyes started to glaze over and my mind did start to wander on various occasions. There was also a strong emphasis on performances of the various pieces, which is okay in small doses, but as the film does go on for over 2 hours, well, I know I'm going to sound like a Philistine, but 2 hours of classical music is, well, frankly, a little bit boring in my opinion. At least I was able to recognize Beethoven's greatest hits, so to speak, things like the Moonlight Sonata, the Sixth Symphony, the Pastoral Symphony, the Ninth Symphony, which includes the Ode to Joy, the anthem of the European Union, and of course the Fifth Symphony, which begins with maybe the most famous four notes in the history of music. Da-da-da-dum. And they even included that
annoying little ditty that all beginner piano students seem to love to play, the Fleur de Lys. So the film is certainly well done, and it is interesting from an historical point of view, but on the whole, I have to say, this is really one for the music buffs, not so much for a general audience, in my opinion. Or maybe one to check out one night on TV, but I reckon unless you're a classical music fan, this is probably not one to go and see at the cinema. And that brings us to the end of the 13th episode of Reality Check here on Joy 94.9. I hope you enjoyed the show. Remember to send any questions, comments, or feedback to realitychecktony@gmail.com. And visit our website at realitycheckonline.net. And remember to tune in at 1 o'clock next Tuesday for episode 14. Okay, have a great week, everyone. See you next week.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.